Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Swanson. Today's episode features content from an educational program titled Contemporary Management of HIV 2021. During this podcast, Dr. David Hardy from the HIV Medicine Association discusses innovative approaches in HIV prevention. For more information on Dr. Hardy and a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides specific to today's discussion, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now, let's get started and hear what Dr. Hardy has to say about HIV prevention using pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Let's open up with our first case of a young MSM with risk factors for PrEP. Our patient is a 31-year-old MSM with recent physical exam for a new job. He does no regular exercise, so he's had about a 20-pound weight gain since the start of COVID pandemic. He uses occasional alcohol and intranasal crystal methamphetamine. He tested positive for syphilis 10 months ago, reports multiple sexual partners. His last monogamous relationship was about 2 years ago. He has no history of previous PrEP use. He is currently interested after reading more about it and seeing the TV commercials about it. So here's one of our poll questions for you. Which PrEP option would you recommend for this individual? Daily tenofovir FTC, daily tenofovir TAF, on-demand FTC tenofovir, on-demand FTC TAF, something else, or you would not recommend PrEP for this individual? All right, so let's move on to the Discover trial. Many of you probably have already read about or heard about this trial. It's been published and presented many times before. Discover basically was a head-to-head comparison among men and transgender women who have sex with men, MSM and transgender women who have sex with men, and compared what was previously the only approved medication for PrEP, FTC tenofovir, and compared a new medication, which is now approved for PrEP, FTC TAF, for HIV prevention. This study was done in the United States and Western Europe, so it was international. And basically, it randomized individuals who had had a history of previous sexual activity, as shown there in the middle of the screen, but the number of condomless sex acts or history of previous STI, randomized them to either daily FTC TAF plus a placebo or FTC tenofovir plus a placebo. So it was double-blind placebo-controlled. The bottom line in the study was outcome was the number of new cases of HIV. And what that actually demonstrated was that there was, in fact, no statistically significant difference between the new number of new cases in the persons receiving FTC tenofovir or FTC TAF. You see that there is actually a numerical difference there, but in looking at the statistical analysis, and because this was a very large study enrolling over 5,500, almost 5,500 participants, there was not a statistical difference, as you can see in the risk ratio there below the numbers, which shows that the two arms of the study were in fact non-inferior or are similar in terms of their ability to prevent HIV infection. And this held up even in a sensitivity analysis, which excluded the five suspected baseline infections, which there were four in the FTC tenofovir arm and one in the FTC TAF arm. So really no difference in terms of efficacy of these two options. The other thing that was actually also put in here in a nested case control study was looking at dried blood spots at the time of HIV diagnosis. And it basically showed that low adherence, less than taking 2 out of 7 doses per week, were associated with significantly increased risk of HIV infection in both arms. So just like we have seen in many other PrEP studies, adherence plays the most important role in terms of whether or not an oral medication like this will work or not. And so I think that's something that really tells us, again, that these options are very similar in terms of their efficacy, and they stop working for the same reason, lack of drug in the blood. The safety was, in fact, a bit different at the end of the 2 years of follow-up for all individuals. Discontinuation rates were low, 1 or 2%. But what was different is that there was better bone and renal safety markers in the FTC TAF arm versus the FTC tenofovir arm. Less excretion of proximal renal tubular proteins in the urine with FTC TAF, and less changes in bone mineral density with TAF versus tenofovir as shown in the table there. It was also of note that weight gain was greater in the patients receiving FTC TAF by about 1.2 kilograms on average at the end of 96 weeks compared to the 1/2 kilogram of weight in the FTC tenofovir. And this is something that I think has kind of run concurrently with other uses of TAF in treatment studies that has in fact shown increased weight in persons receiving TAF for treatment for HIV infection as well. The next thing is just a couple of ideas about what if the individual starting PrEP were a cisgender woman, would that make a difference? Well, in fact, it would, because TAF has not been tested in cisgender women, and therefore the FDA could not make a decision about it, and therefore TAF is only approved for men who have sex with men and transgender women who are at risk for HIV infection. What if it was a person who injects drugs? Again, TAF has not been studied in persons who inject drugs. Tenofovir FTC has, and that would be the choice to go with. Had pre-existing renal or bone disease or other presence of other risk factors involving this. And in fact, I think that's where TAF probably has one of its greatest utilities, is that trying to prevent renal or bone disease would be a good idea, as the safety data showed from the DiSCOVER study, or had concerns about his or her lipid profile. We know that tenofovir does in fact, to a certain extent, although not greatly, like a statin, lowers lipids, whereas TAF actually has no great effect on them really at all. So that might be part of the discussion you may have in terms of which choice to make. So what is the role of on-demand PrEP in HIV prevention? For those of you who follow this area for a while, we know that there's been two big studies in the world, both located in France and French-speaking Canada, which demonstrated that a 2-1-1 dosing strategy of using on-demand PrEP, meaning taking it, linking it to an anticipated and then following up after a sexual act, is a alternative to taking PrEP as opposed to one pill once a day. It's important, first of all, to point out that neither the FDA in the US nor the CDC recommend on-demand PrEP. However, some of our guidelines have in fact made some recommendations about it outside of this, including the IAS USA, who has recommended on-demand PrEP only for MSM, because that's the only area it has really been studied. Some transgender women, however, also. And the World Health Organization says that a practitioner may consider on-demand PrEP for MSM with infrequent sexual exposure, or who can plan their ability to have sex very carefully. there is no data of note about the use of on-demand PrEP with FTC TAF. So no TAF data for on-demand. The important thing I think here is to remember that this population in which this was studied was pretty significantly small, and that's MSM and transgender women. So it has not been studied in heterosexual men, or heterosexual women, transgender men, or women, or people with HBV infection. Again, to point out, the 2-1-1 dosing is basically two tablets of FTC tenofovir 2 to 24 hours before sex. One has to be predictable about having their sex. And then if sex does occur, a third tablet 24 hours after the sex, and again, a fourth tablet 48 hours after the sex. So it's 2-1-1. And if there's multiple sexual intercourses, then basically you keep taking the one tablet until you're 2 days out from the last sexual encounter. Let's move on to our third case, which is a 27-year-old cisgender African-American woman employed in the banking industry with a demanding work schedule. She has no chronic medical conditions. She does use current oral contraceptives. She uses occasional alcohol, but no illicit drug use, and reports variable condom use. She was engaged up until 9 months ago when her fiance cheated on her, and now she's single. She started dating men 7 months ago using dating apps, and has had two sexual partners recently. So kind of the other big news in the world of prevention that was presented at the HIV Research for Prevention earlier this year was the companion study to HPTN-083 that I just told you about. HPTN-084 was the study, I call it the sister study really, of looking at the very same arms of prevention, either an arm of the gold standard at the time, tenofovir FTC given daily, versus the new kid on the block, injectable cabotegravir given every two months. And this study was done specifically in cisgender women in sub-Saharan Africa. You may ask, why was this not done in the United States? And many researchers have asked that as well. And the primary reason is that the incidence of HIV infection among women in the U.S. in most parts of the U.S., except for some places, was too small in order to be able to enroll enough women to show a difference. But this study could do it in sub-Saharan Africa, and in fact did. Its study design is exactly like the study we went over before, 083, with a placebo-controlled double dummy sort of design with an oral lead-in, then switched over to injectable. And the primary endpoints were, of course, new HIV infections. The baseline characteristics of these women, and there were, in fact, about 3,200, was that the majority were less than 25 years old. They were not living with their sexual partners. Most had sex with a person who was, about a third had sex with a person who was HIV positive or unknown status. The majority had greater than two sexual partners. 41% were involved in transactional sex, meaning probably sex for money, sex for food, sex for housing. And the others had been in, the others, I think, really, details really show that these were women who were considered to be at risk for HIV infection. Of note that 55% were in the BMI category of overweight greater than 25. So again, looking at the incidence of new HIV infections, we see that in the cabotegravir arm, four women large number that were enrolled, 1,600 versus 36 out of 1,600 in the FTC TAF arm. Again, it was shown here that the injectable cabotegravir had almost a 90% lower risk of HIV infection. And this did in fact also meet, as in the 083 study, the level for statistical superiority of cabotegravir injectable over daily FTC tenofovir. Among the incident HIV infections, two occurred despite cab injections. So there again, there were two out of those four in which the explanation for why they occurred has still yet to really be understood. The other two were explainable by a break in adherence. And as you can see here, just like on the previous slide I showed you from HPT and 083, explainable infection because of the absence of an injection, but in two of those cases, D1 and D2, we see that the injections did occur, were documented to occur. Although in a couple of situations there and the D1, the injections were greater than 2 weeks overdue, and that may have had something to do with it, but certainly in D2, everything looked okay. Yet to be learned from this one case about how that infection occurred. When we look at the adherence for tenofovir, we know that the daily adherence of this medication is important. We see that the amount of detectable tenofovir in the plasma concentration did in fact decrease over time from a high at 77% week four down to 53% at week 57. And the proportion of patients that had at least 40 nanograms per ml in their blood also decreased from around 60 to 34%. So adherence did wane, and it'll be interesting to see how much that affected the incidence. Of course, it probably would. In terms of the cabotegravir injection coverage, the proportion of the time at which injections were in fact given on schedule was 94% in the first 6 months, and that really didn't decrease greatly up to 30 months, where it was still 90%. So another assessment, our first assessment question, Based on the phase 4 HPTN-084 trial, the women done in women, cisgender women in sub-Saharan Africa, how could you counsel an HIV negative cisgender woman regarding the use of cabotegravir long-acting every eight weeks compared to daily oral FTC PrEP? A, is cabotegravir long-acting superior to FTC? Is FTC tenofovir? Is cabotegravir non-inferior to FTC tenofovir? Adherence rates were numerically similar for CAB-LA and FTC tenofovir. Adherence rates were numerically lower for CAB-LA versus FTC tenofovir, or you're unsure. And again, just to make point of the fact, the correct answer was in fact A, because there was an 89% lower risk of HIV infection with CAB-LA versus FTC tenofovir. So let's move on a little bit more and look at some of the other side of the coin of HPTN-084 in terms of injection site reactions, STIs, and weight change. In terms of the occurrence of any injection site reactions in the women in this study occurred at 21%. Interestingly, 32% with CAB, 9% with a placebo. The grade 2 injection site reactions were about 4% in terms of severity, 7% with CAB and 9% with FTC tenofovir. Really very interesting there. But there were no discontinuations due to injection site reactions. The first time I've seen this happen in any injectable, but very important. The incidence of STIs was very similar in both arms of the study and really showed us that these women were in fact sexually active. And in terms of initial weight increase in the CAB arm, which was about 0.42 kilograms over this period of time. And when we look at that in across treatment arms, overall it was about 2.4 kilograms per year in the cabotegravir arm and 2.2 for the FTC TAF. So really no difference was being seen here as there was in the 083 study in transgender women and MSM. Pregnancy outcomes, because of course there were 50 confirmed pregnancies despite the required use of birth control during this study, 1.5 in the CAB arm, 1.1 incidence in the FTC TAF arm, tenofovir arm, 29 versus 21. When we look at the pregnancy outcomes of those 29 and 20 of those pregnancy outcomes in which there were 14 and 13 that have actually delivered, 10 and 10 of live births, pregnancy loss were less than 20 weeks, 3 in the CAB, 1 in the FTC tenofovir. Notable that this does include elective terminations, no ectopic pregnancies, and in terms of congenital abnormalities, none in 10 out of 11 in the CAB arm and in 10 out of 12 in the FTC arm, and then unknown in 3 and 1. So this, I think, does show that so far there's no signal that either medication has been associated with some deleterious pregnancy effects to date. So when we think about this, you know, extending this into the adolescent study population is very important. And there was ongoing studies called HPTN-083-01 and 083-01, which are enrolling sexually active HIV negative, generally healthy adolescents below the age of 18. 50 cisgender men and transgender women who are sick with men, and 50 cisgender females. They have to be not currently receiving another PrEP medication. Young women have to be using long-acting reversible contraception. And the studies are going on both in the U.S. and also in sub-Saharan Africa, as shown on this slide. We'll learn more about that as time goes on to see how this perhaps could be used in other areas. I think one of the things that was really also important about these studies is they really elicited a interest in wanting to have community input in terms of the use of oral PrEP and synchronized efforts to really tell people about cabotegravir LA. Because to have two studies like 083 and 084, both of which have shown superiority to one of the current gold standards for PrEP, is very, very important. And how to inform the community about this becomes something that is really, really, I think, incumbent upon the research community and the treating community in HIV to make sure that there is, in fact, thoughtful information about how persons at risk Reykjavik can be informed of this information. And that's where the AVAC organization, a community-based preventative HIV prevention group, has actually been working on trying to find a good way to do this. They have, in fact, identified priorities for successful CAB-LA introduction. And I'm not going to go into detail in these different four different areas, but just to make note of the fact, and if you're interested, grab that URL at the bottom. But it really, I think, talks about how people can be informed about the use of CAB-LA for both transgender women and MSM, as well as for cisgender women as well.
Well, thank you very much to Dr. Hardy, and thanks also to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full educational program, Contemporary Management of HIV 2021, on the Clinical Care Options website, click on the link in the show notes. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.